is Marketing Over Coffee with Christopher Penn and John Wall.
Hello and welcome to Marketing Over Coffee. I'm John Wall. And normally Christopher Penn and myself spend about 25 minutes talking about what's going on in the world of marketing. This week, though, we've got a lot of things going on. Christopher is actually down at the Marketing Profs Digital Mixer in Arizona and is doing a session there today and is there for at least for another day. And this morning I was in New York City at an event that Seth Godin had held for the release of his new book, Tribes. And so instead of the normal show, what I've got is the audio from the Tribes session. This is about an hour and 20 minutes worth of stuff, and it's just the presentation. I also have another about an hour and 40 worth of Q&A, and I think I'll put those into a weekend edition and put those out next week. But I wanted to get the first chunk out here. And again, it's a lot of stuff, but I think you'll really enjoy it. And with that, we will see you next week. And until then, enjoy the coffee.
Without further ado, let me introduce today's speaker. That would be me. So, there are a lot of things that people who do what I do for a living try to sell in terms of where you're going and what you need and what you want. And it takes a lot of hubris to do that, to stand up and say, I think this will benefit you. I think this is worthwhile. And I'm the first to admit that I'm standing here with a fair amount of hubris saying that. But I have a feeling that I do know what you want. And I think what you want is more. And by more, I mean more sales and more followers and more attention, more people knowing your idea, more faith in the future, more power to make things happen the way you want them to happen, more connections with other people, more, more, and more. Some of those things are related to business, some of those things are related to culture, but most of all, what people do for a living is they try to grow what they have. So I was thinking about that when I was thinking about a guy I know named Joel Spolsky. I'm in Joel's tribe, and by that I mean that I read Joel's blog. Joel has influenced me in the way I think about software programming, in the way I think about hiring people, in the way I think about how you build a company. So when it came time for me to buy software that would help track bugs at my startup company, there weren't any choices. Joel makes that, I bought it. And I bought it because of the relationship I have with him and because of the fact that over the years, his ideas have influenced me and have connected me with other people who share those ideas. At the other extreme is Jacqueline Novogratz. I'm in her tribe as well. Jacqueline Novogratz is almost single-handedly on a mission to change the way philanthropy works. That she has spent the last 20 years of her life in the developing world rejecting the idea that you can give people aid and magically have the world get better, but instead using know-how and capital from the West to help people help themselves to grow businesses that matter. And what's fascinating is that Jacqueline has done this with no unfair leg up, with no connections, but instead by building a tribe. And then what I want to talk to you about today fits inside that whole spectrum. And what it says is that the world has changed in a great number of ways in the way ideas spread. That those changes are affecting the way every single person grows. It used to be that the way you grew was you bought ads, as many ads as you could afford, preferably ads with babies. If you can't afford enough ads with babies, buy ads with doctors in them. But the model was that what you can do for a living is interrupt people, hopefully without poor juxtapositions, interrupt them over and over and over again until finally they bought your product, or they gave money to your cause, or they joined your organization. And a key engine of that was television. Right? TV thinking says, I'm a marketer, I have money, I can interrupt whoever I want, whenever I want, as often as I want, until I make enough money to interrupt more people. And the power of this thinking led to an explosion in mass media, particularly TV, which led to an explosion in clutter, which led to more and more and more choices, which led to all of these organizations who spend all their time interrupting as many people as they can to make money doing it by selling ads. And we all grew up with that culture. That's the way we think things are supposed to work. I'm going to grow by interrupting someone who doesn't want to hear from me and make enough money doing it to interrupt more people. That the shorthand version of it is you find exactly the right person, you assault them with an idea, and maybe, just maybe, you'll convert them into someone who is actually a customer. The timeline looks like this. So step one was Charlie the Tuna. Let's figure out something that has nothing to do with the product. Put on a show, a jingle, maybe people will buy from us. Step two, let's spam people because we deserve it. It's our job, we have the right. So we will spam you by email and spam you with robocalls and spam you at home and spam you at work. And we'll bother you with direct mail and salespeople will call you until finally you give up and buy from us. Then the internet came along and we said, great, the idea virus, viral marketing, that's the answer. What we'll do is we'll just get people to all talk about us because we deserve it. And the sad news that I have to share with you, I'm afraid, is that those days are now over. They're not ending fast enough for all the critics and skeptics to embrace, but there's no question they're ending very quickly. No brand, not one, consumer brand built in the last 10 years has been built on the back of television. That if we look at why the dot-com companies crashed and burned, a lot of that had to do with Wall Street and venture capitalists, but a lot of that had to do with spending $80 million on ads with sock puppets in them. That the idea that you can interrupt your way to success, that's a problem, and it's not really working. So you can panic if you're in the PR business. You can panic if this is what you built your business on. You can panic if this is how you were selling real estate. Or you can realize that there's good news. The good news is that a much more organic and predictable and scalable and genuine system is showing a resurgence. But the good news is that the other system, which was based on money, is being replaced by a different system, a system that's based on a couple questions. The first question that people ask when they hear about something, an event, a product, an organization is, who else is involved? Where did this come from? Who else is going to be there? And the second question they ask is, who is going to lead us? And that the opportunity, and the thing I'm going to come back to over and over and over again, is this. The opportunity is that there is an almost infinite number of tribes that want to be formed, that are forming, groups that people want to join. And there's a dramatic shortage of leaders. And it turns out, if you look at the people who have become leaders, who are successful at leading, the only thing they have in common is that they're leaders. And there's nothing keeping any of you from filling that void. It's not about money, it's not about where you went to school, it's not about where you were born. That in fact, there are other attributes that we're going to go into today that inform whether or not you can pull this off. So what I need to do is explain to you what I mean when I talk about tribes. And what I mean when I talk about markets and stuff. I'm going to start with a cartoon from my friend Hugh, which is this. We look at the economy and we say, oh my God, the stock market's down. Oh my God, there's a recession. But the fact is that what people have been buying, once they buy food and shelter and healthcare, what they buy is meaning. What they buy is something that makes them feel good. The stuff that people want, as opposed to the stuff that people need, has been the search for meaning. And so when I show you this tribe, the Star Wars tribe, and you see these fully grown adults dressed up as Imperial stormtroopers, you say, what's that about? How much did they get paid to do that? They didn't get paid to do it. They did it because it made them feel good. They did it because they want to belong to a group. Because belonging to a tribe is a fundamental element of being a human being. And during our lifetimes, there have only been three big tribes. The reason is because TV and the mass media have drowned out our desire, our ability to join these tribes. So the first one is church, usually one church per town. That's been historic. The second one is work, the tribe we join of the people that we work with. And the third one is community, the people that we live with and near. Those three tribes have been constant throughout all human history. But there's billions of other tribes out there, literally billions, that people can and will join. So the shift goes from, how do I yell at people, who are carefully targeted, a hunting term, how do I yell at enough people to make me some money to get me an article written to sell a house, versus how do I create these movements so that people naturally and organically find each other and do what they want to do in the first place, which is connect. So the Red Hat ladies are a fine example. You can go almost anywhere in the world and you'll find women of a certain age hanging out at a cafe wearing the red hats. It just seemed to have sprung out of nowhere. But of course it didn't. Someone came up with it and it spread. And why do they do it? They're not paying or getting paid. They do it because of the way it makes them feel. Or the triathlon, you know, with the silly bathing capsules. These people don't even like swimming. Ask any of them. They hate the swimming part. So why exactly do they spend 9 or 11 hours doing it? It's because of the tribe, because of the connection. That what tribes are groups of people who share something in common, a mission, a language, a leader, a movement, someplace they want to go. That what the internet has done, the giant paradox here, it was supposed to homogenize everyone and make the world smaller. What it's done is made it so that Ukrainian folk dancers could find each other, because you can't really Ukrainian folk dance by yourself. What it did was allow fundamentalists to be more extreme, because they could isolate themselves when they chose and work with the real world when they chose. Then what it did was it made it so that rodeo fans knew where the other rodeo fans were, and it made it easier to be loud about being a rodeo fan or a rodeo fan. You knew where to go and what to shop and what to buy because of these connections. Each group finding itself because it wants to. Now, a lot of this is based on ancient archetypes. You know, the warrior with his princess riding away on his steed. Updated by Harley Davidson. It's a natural inclination, and there are people who pay a $5,000 premium to drive that motorcycle because it's the symbol of their born tribe. And some of them are just plain ancient. That these tribes have been around for a really long time. It's possible to own the intellectual property that an entire tribe is based on. If you're MGM, this is a good thing that every year on Halloween, millions of people dress up like Dorothy. So let's do a little experiment here. If you would. Good. 4 seconds, 5 seconds. Every group I've ever tried that with over the years has been able to pull that off. And every group claps at a different rhythm. I did not show you at which rhythm to clap, and yet you figured it out. How could that be? It turns out that human beings like doing what other human beings are doing. Not necessarily what all human beings are doing, but what other human beings in their tribe choose to do. It's important to us. And so we watch TV shows about fictional tribes, and amazingly, their habits and language and everything else leaks into the real world. And now those tribes show up in real life. That we don't have to wear a smock to trade stocks, even though sometimes it's pretty dirty. But the point is, these guys are wearing a red smock because it indicates to them that they're a member of a tribe. This is my favorite. They all share the same facial expressions when things aren't going well. Right? Why? Why is it? It's because culturally they like doing what other people are doing even when things aren't going well. Why do they wear white in the kitchen or white on a Navy ship? I don't know. It doesn't matter. What matters is that they're all in uniform for a reason. Because it connects them. Because it makes them members of a tribe. Silly hats work too. Hats all over the world. I have no idea what this girl's going to tell her family when she takes them home for dinner. But the point is that this was a choice by ordinary people who want to belong. These are members of an actual tribe, the Outdoor Competitive Ironing League. And they use battery-powered irons and go all over the world ironing. It seems silly unless you're in it. And when you're in it, it means you found some place where you belong. This, as you know, is one of my favorite pictures. It's a real photo. Apparently, volunteer firemen do this a lot. And then they train on a house that was going to be torn down anyway. And then they stop in the middle and take a picture of themselves. The picture is important. The uniforms are important. Volunteer firemen risking their lives for free. because of the way it makes us feel, because of the way they connect them. Every night in America, women, women who work in an office, women with good jobs, instead of watching TV, go out and do roller derby and try to hurt themselves for free, because it matters. That the Shriners have raised hundreds of millions of dollars for their charities and ridden the silly bikes with the silly hats, because it matters to be a Shriner. And it's happening online as well. Now, what we're seeing are geek tribes being built and being led, and an old kind of geek tribe. Sports is another example that I really like, because when you're a sports fan, who exactly are you rooting for? The players are all different than they were last year. The coach is going to get fired. Are you rooting for the building? No. What you're doing is you're rooting for yourself. That when the team wins, you win, because you're identifying with them. That the other people in the stands are you. That's how you labeled yourself. That's why sports teams are able to hold cities for ransom and build these really expensive stadiums that never, ever make a profit. Because what we're doing is we're building a monument to ourselves. That what we're doing is celebrating ourselves and the people we're connected with. And it happens at work. What happens at work is we also wear a uniform. We also have a limbo, and we stick with it probably longer than economically feasible, because it's not just the job. Being part of that tribe defines in large measure who we are, and even if it changes, we're still going to do it, because it's who we are. Now, some definitions here. It's really important to understand. There's a difference, between a crowd and a tribe. Crowd is a bunch of people. A tribe are people who have something in common, a movement, a message, a connection. Pirates are a great example. Pirates are clearly a tribe. They even have their own flag. But if you see somebody who's a pirate, you immediately know. Because they talk that funny way, and they got the peg leg and the parrot. There's all these things going on that make it clear that those people aren't just part of a crowd of criminals. They're actually part of a tribe. And Einstein was a member of this tribe of physicists. And if you were an insider, you had access to the best papers and the best teachers and were more likely to succeed. In the same era, this group of people who went to see Harry Houdini do a death-defying trick were not part of a tribe. Right? They're still wearing all the same hats, but it doesn't matter. There are no outsiders here. Once there are no outsiders, there's no tribe. There's just a bunch of people coming to see a magic trick. Whereas at a country music concert, yeah, I would argue these people clearly are. They share a language. They share a connection. You can often tell by the costumes, by the hats, by the fact that people are going out of their way to self-identify. Now, the insider and outside thing becomes really important. If this guy were at home in Seattle, he'd be giving these guys the funny look, because he'd be in the majority. But right here, in this city, on this bench, he's an outsider. He's not part of the tribe, which brings these people closer together. Now, sometimes people do view this as sort of a silly affectation. But the very same affectation can talk to bloodlines and generations through the years, people connecting to each other over history. But again, it's not about traffic jam. It's not about what you as a marketer are used to measuring. It's not about hits or page views or click-throughs. It's not about gross rating points. It's not about how many people you got to come to the grand opening of your supermarket. That is crowd generation. Give me money, I can buy you a crowd. Crowds are getting more expensive, but it can still be done. That's what marketers want to do, because it feels like they're in control. It feels like they're in charge. But part of the message, and I'm working my way up to the real meat here, is that even though it's more difficult to earn a tribe, it's way more powerful. It matters. It's far bigger than word of mouth. It's way bigger than crowd generation. So here's an artificial Seth Godin chart with made up data points in it that look really official. I was talking to Jim Collins. He and I don't know each other well. He taught me years ago at Stanford, but we haven't seen each other often. He gets up and he has real data. And I get up and I have make-believe data. There's room for both of us in the world. So on the left, you see brand value increasing as the quality of tribal connection goes up. And just run any stock you want through this chart and you'll see that it works. That the Harley Davidsons and the Apples of the world are over here because there's a high tribal connection. And then over here are people who might have the ability to generate a crowd, but it's not going to last. That what's really powerful, particularly for the people in this room, is the leverage that you get because it doesn't cost money to build a tribe. And once the tribe is in place, it grows organically and gets more powerful as it gets bigger. Here's a quick chart of Barack Obama's fundraising numbers. I've left out the last 2 months, which are way off the charts. And what you see is that someone with no real connections, with no real insider status, was able to generate millions and millions and millions of dollars from lots and lots of people doing it the new way, as opposed to doing it the old way. The Grateful Dead were doing this 40 years ago. We know that for at least 10 years, the Grateful Dead were the number one grossing live act in the world. We're talking $40, $50, $60, $100 million in a year. Even though they only had one song hit the top 40 in their entire career. So how does that work? Because the Grateful Dead weren't in the business of selling records. The Grateful Dead led a tribe. They put on a rolling party that went from city to city, and most of their fans went to every single one of the shows. Some came and some went, but that's what they were in the business of doing. That they gave people access to the music because it was the soundtrack for the tribe. That the dress that evolved, the dancing that evolved, the lingo that evolved, the way that they could talk to each other, all of which connected people. And that's why when Jerry died, there was this loss, not because I can't listen to the records anymore, of course I can, but because the leader of the tribe was gone, leaving a hole in the middle of the donut. Here's a site you probably haven't been to called Piano World. More than a million posts so far. People go to Piano World and post things like, this top one, I'm going to have a party on September 6th in Auburn, Maine. Come play the piano. And 20 or 30 people will come to this woman's house where she has a Steinway, and they'll all play piano for each other. And they may not know each other when they arrive, but of course they do know each other because they've met on the boards and because they love this central idea. It also works at work. This is a woman named Mitch Matthews. Mitch is Senior VP of Marketing, Microsoft. She runs a tribe of 2,000 marketers at Microsoft, none of whom report to her, maybe three. But they all talk the same. They believe the same things. They wear the same clothes, even though they work in offices across the world. Once or twice a year, they get together for a big event, which is where I met her. And what was fascinating is, by creating this culture, this belief system, she is managing them by leading them, by creating an environment where they're all on the same page. So yeah, the tribe's thing works at work as well. This is a hero of mine named Bo Taylor. I never got to meet Bo, he died a few months ago. Bo Taylor grew up on the wrong side of Los Angeles. He was a member of the Crips. And he spent his entire young life, before he was 25, fighting against the Bloods to the death. That is a really profound, clear tribe, and with all of the things that go with it. And after the riots in LA, he realized what was happening and devoted the rest of his life to trying to get the two tribes to work together, to do something other than be committed to destroying each other. This is a friend of mine, Megan Casey. She runs the tribe at Squidoo. Now, I have to use the word runs really carefully because you don't get to tell people in the tribe what to do. But you can lead them. You can give them a platform. You can elevate the people who are making the biggest differences and help them have more influence on the others. And that's what she does all day. There are almost no organizations I know of that have people who do that all day. But once you commit an organization to it, or the leader of an organization to it, it changes what you do all day. How many of you know who Gary Vee is? Right? Look at this. Here's a guy with no media connections, starting with no investment, who now has millions of people around the world who listen to him and follow him when he wants to talk about what he's passionate about. And that what he's getting really good at is connecting you to each other so that he actually has to spend less time doing it and more value is created. If we look at the nonprofit world, we've got Kiva versus the United Way. Now, I'm a fan of the United Way. My dad ran it as a volunteer one year when I was growing up. But the United Way is all about the old way of doing it. Top down, payroll deduction. We'll go to big corporations and we'll interrupt you once a year to get you to pay us. Kiva said, wait, that's not the way it's going to work in the future. So Kiva doesn't want anyone to give them money. What Kiva says is, here's a bunch of people who want a loan. Here's a bunch of people who want to be connected to each other and make loans. Let's introduce them to each other and get out of the way. And as a result, fastest growing charity, probably in history, number one charity online. So let's take a second here and talk about some of the dynamics of what's happening in this tribe of thinking. It starts, as most of my thinking does, with the death of the factory. The factory thinking, making lots and lots of stuff and shipping it out, doesn't work like it used to. And factory thinking is built around the idea of a king. Royalty has affected the way we think about a lot of stuff. The king, his court, the decrees, following what the top leader says. And if you're a CEO of a major corporation, or you are a senior official in a major religion, you are used to standing at the front and shooting things at the back of the room. You have organized everything you're doing on this mindset. This mindset of saying, I'm in charge, I worked really hard to get here, everyone else is downstream from me. The internet, of course, changes that. We don't have 6 degrees of separation anymore. We have 4, more and more people connected. But I'm not talking about how many friends you have on Facebook. It's irrelevant. I'm not talking about how big your LinkedIn network is. That's not a tribe. Those are people who really just won't complain if you spam them now and then. I'm talking about something more important. I'm talking about movements. Groups of people who want to make change happen. And that's important, because things don't spread because you want them to. Things spread because other people want them to, because I want them to. I'm going to tell someone because it's good for me, not good for the guy who owns the Momo Fuku restaurant. So if you're the brand manager for Tide, you have a problem. And the problem is everything in your business is based on Oma, on your efficient factory, on your ability to get shelf space, on the money you have to buy ads. And if you're sitting there saying, I deserve a tribe, I deserve to lead people, how are we going to build a network for people who want clothes cleaner than clean? You're delusional. It's not going to happen. That doesn't mean you're going to go out of business, but it does mean you're not going to grow, not going to grow like you used to, because none of us care about cleaner than clean. And until you come up with something we care about, we're going to ignore you. Really interesting to think about the Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market fooled themselves into thinking they had a tribe. Because when you went to all their markets, the same sort of people were there. And they gave each other a little nod, and they shared a lifestyle. But then Whole Foods said, wait, we're public, we need to make more money, let's raise the prices, build more stores, get more people to come. Instead of saying, wait a minute, what we can do for a living here is be purveyors and connectors to a special tribe, right? A smaller tribe. Instead, they went the old model, they acted like Procter and Gamble. They viewed their customers as just customers, people to make money from. So let me stop here and say where we are. Tribes are faster and longer lasting and more powerful, but they are not free, right? They're not free because they take a huge amount of effort. And that effort is an expense. It's a commitment. It's a moral obligation. And that what most marketers will do and will fail at is they'll do it because they're going to make a living at it. They'll do it because it's the only alternative to doing what they want to do, which is buying more TV ads. And so the giant warning, and the fascinating thing, reading the book just before I sent it in, I said to myself, wait a minute. Most of this book is not about what I just talked about for the last 25 minutes. Most of this book says, okay, if you want to do that, there are no tactics I can tell you. There are no 5-step approaches. There are no easy ways to manipulate people into following you. None of that will work. And rather than pretending it will work and doing what a lot of people would have really liked, which is do these 7 things, check off these 6 boxes, and say these 7 incantations, I called the marketer's bluff. And I said, you can't do it that way. I got an old slide in there. I don't know how I did that. There we go. You can't do it that way. Then what you have to do is something fundamentally different. It's not business as usual. The Mormon Church, well known for being the fastest growing church in American history. And a lot of people think they grow because the missionaries go door to door ringing bells, which is basically human spam. Ring the bell, interrupt people who don't want to hear from you, move on. But if you look deeply into the numbers, what you see is that they grow because 4 people become a community of 8 or 16. Neighbors talking to neighbors, family members talking to family members. That it is, in fact, class of tribal behavior. If we know about Gar Reynolds for a minute, Gar Reynolds runs presentationsn.com. How many of you have been to the site? How many of you have bought the book? Okay, so last year, 125,000 or more, I can't remember the number, books got published in the United States. Among new authors, maybe 12 made it to the Amazon 500, and maybe 2 made it to the Amazon Top 50 for the year, and Gar Reynolds was one of them. So I look at Gar Reynolds, and I don't know what he looks like, so I had to take a picture of one of his slides instead. The fact that I don't know what he looks like is important to the story, because not only did I buy a copy of his book, but according to my Scudoo page, I sold hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of copies of his book because I blogged about it, because I'm a member of his tribe. It's a movement of people who are sick and tired of bullet-filled, ugly PowerPoint presentations. And I benefit when that group of people, the ones who are making ugly presentations, get the message that Gar is sending. And I find that when I meet someone who makes presentations like I make presentations, that we like each other. Just like sometimes when I meet someone in Whole Foods, it turns out we like each other. What Gar did, though, is he really led this tribe. He connected this tribe. He was generous to the tribe. He created a movement around an idea. And when the book came out, it was merely a souvenir. It was merely the document that we could use to give to the people who don't get it yet, so they can start following. Or even more technical, Avinash Kaushik. How many of you know Avinash? Fewer, but still an amazingly large number. Another bestseller from an unknown author in 12 languages so far. Why? Because Avinash goes around the world meeting with tribes of people who are obsessed with measurement and analytics. Yes, there are people like that. And when Avinash meets them, he connects them to each other. Autodesk didn't realize there were all these other people at Autodesk who were obsessed with his way of looking at the world, but there were. And by creating a center where there didn't used to be one, he was able to connect people who desperately wanted to be connected to create a tribe. In the offline world, in the physical world, let's talk about the M.Dot triathlon. Turns out there's triathlons all over. I didn't tell that guy to tattoo the word tribe to his leg. He just did. Turns out that you can run a triathlon in your backyard if you live near a body of water, right? All you gotta do is swim 2 miles and do all that other stuff. Why then, if you didn't qualify for the real triathlon, the M.Dot triathlon, the one in Hawaii, why would you pay $40,000 to enter a race you know you're gonna lose? Right? Because if you didn't qualify, you're gonna lose. Because it's a tribal event. The M.Dot people are rolling in money because they figured out how to unite this group of people that had no one uniting them. Interesting rule about tribes. I've got a few here, some of which I learned from you in the online tribe thing. The reverse Groucho rule. Groucho Marx, famous for saying, I don't want to be a member of any club that would have me. The reverse Groucho rule is, I don't want to be a member of any club that would have you. And then one of the challenges, think about that for a minute, one of the challenges that you have if you want to lead and run a tribe is that lots of tribes don't want to let other people in. Lots of tribes are quite content to keep it small, quite content to keep it special. Leave the riffraff out, please. And then overcoming that becomes important if you've made a choice that you need a big tribe. There are two things you can do with a tribe. One thing you can do with your tribe is you can make it tighter. Right? So you can take the existing group you've got and get them more committed. The Hare Krishnas are good at this. You gotta wear the outfit, you gotta be a vegetarian, you gotta shave your head, you gotta sing the songs. So it's not easy to become a Hare Krishna, but once you're in, you're in. The other thing you can do, though, is you can make your tribe bigger. That by making the tribe bigger, you simulate this sort of power. Oprah Winfrey's tribe keeps getting bigger. You know why? Because it only takes 2 hours to join. You watch the TV show, you're in. It's free, you're done. And so she has a big tribe, but not nearly the impact per person that the Hare Krishnas have. This decision becomes important because if you look at the entire universe of the world, it's very easy to say, wait a minute, you can't come, you're a sports fan, you can't come because I don't like you, you can't come because of this. And then over time, as tribes get more and more exclusionary, they may get more pure, but they also get a lot smaller. And then what you need to do as you approach this problem, this challenge, is you gotta think in advance, what kind of tribe do you want? Would it be possible for this event to have 2,000 people at it if I had promoted it in a different way and been more aggressive and spent more money? Probably. But it wouldn't have been worth nearly as much because it wouldn't have been the right people. You're the right people. You're the right people because it wasn't that easy to get here. wasn't that easy to find out about it. It wasn't that easy to jump through all the hoops. That's on purpose, because it makes it tighter. And once it's tighter, it makes it more likely that the people who are doing it are committed. And when people are committed, things get done. That, in fact, you are no longer a marketing manager. Managers, by the way, don't lead. Managers take yesterday's work and do it again tomorrow, but a little cheaper. They know what they want, and they know how it's done. Leaders aren't sure what's going to happen next. They just have a vision. That's what leadership is, unveiling the future. So I compare, say, Duran Duran to someone who's leading a tribe. Duran Duran does a comeback. They do their album. They put up billboards. They put up the website with all the rollovers and the JavaScript. And it's a failure, because they're just yelling at people. There's no Duran Duran tribe. They abandoned the tribe 20 years ago, and they just left them alone. And instead of coming back and organically growing this group of people, they just started yelling and hoped that people would come back. Whereas the Red Sox, if they're Red Sox fans, this is where usually they sigh. The Red Sox looked at the world. They said, wait, we won the World Series, but we're not going to win every year. We can't get a new stadium, because this one's the one we got. So how are we going to grow? They decided to do things like hire all-star Japanese baseball players at high salaries. Why? It extends the tribe into a whole new country. They decided to create garb and clothing and expressions that can be transcending geography and connect people who want to be against the Yankees, who like being underdogs, and it's worked. Nature Conservancy. Figuring out how to build a brand that people are willing to tattoo on the back of their head. Another decision about tightness versus scale. Now, one thing you've got to understand is that every market has people who might join your tribe. But not everyone will ever join any tribe. If everyone joins every tribe, it's not a tribe anymore. Oxygen breathing, that's not a tribe. It's just something everyone does. So you may have something for the yellow circles, but not the purple circles. And you need to think about the fact that you're never going to convert everyone, that you don't need to convert everyone. All right, so this is the point at which I get annoyed. Because what a lot of people want to know is, tell me exactly how to do this. Tell me what I should do tomorrow to make this work. Now, it's fun to riff about what you might do. That this tribe that many of you belong to, which has thousands of people in it, we learned a lot doing it. But the stuff that we learned is useless to you, because it's just a tactic. When I did a Wordle word map of my book, and what's fascinating about it is if you look at the words that show up the most often, they have nothing to do with what you should do exactly tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. That's not my job. My job is to make you uncomfortable enough that you're not doing something. That you will start looking at the opportunities in front of you and find the path to get there. That the problem, the challenge that organizations of every stripe have, isn't that they can't do this, it's that they're not sold on wanting to do it. And that what we need to do before we're going to get the leadership we deserve, the leadership that we need, is we're going to decide that we need the leadership. Once we decide we need it, we're going to find it. So you could put up statues. That's a tactic that works. It builds long-term, multi-generational tribes. But wait a minute. These guys don't have any statues. And they don't have any of the dogma that someone else might have, but it worked for them. You take a look at a politician. The first time Al Gore was out there trying to build a tribe, he failed and didn't end up getting the White House. The second time, he used a completely different set of tactics and changed the way the world thought about global warming. You might not know this, but more than 1,000 people have paid money, gone to Nashville, and been trained in how to give Al Gore's slideshow. And every single night, somewhere, dozens of people are giving it. Then it grows. They teach other people how to give it, and it grows. Here are two tribe leaders. What exactly do they have in common? It's not clear to me that I could say these tactics are right and these tactics aren't right, or vice versa. That the tactics aren't as important as the results that you get. So if I look at CrossFit, a group of slightly mentally unhinged people who do insane exercises in gyms at night, outdoors, in the dark, and then post pictures of themselves ripping tendons and hurting themselves and bleeding and cuts. The point is that they do it because they want to. And that Coach Gary, who leads the tribe, figured out how to work with this tribe the way this tribe needed to be worked with. And as a result, there's tens of thousands of people across the country. Every time he opens a new gym or one of his followers opens a gym, it's instantly sold out. The classes are full, not because he's talking to me or to you, but he's talking to somebody else who really needs to hear it. And he's leading them the way they need to be led. So this is Laura Fitton. How many of you follow Laura on Twitter? A bunch. So Laura, stay-at-home mom, two kids, starts Twittering a couple years ago. Now she has thousands of people following her, and she makes a really good living consulting about social media. With no fancy business cards, no office, she works from home, and she's raising two kids. Why? Because she figured out how to lead a group of 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 marketers online, 180 characters at a time. And that idea that the tactic doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's Facebook or a stamp. It doesn't matter if you're doing it over the PA system at a school or marching down the street in the developing world. The tactic isn't the key. The key is getting in sync with the people who are actually going to be connected. There's this great story that I talk about in the book. I almost called the book Positive Deviance, but then it would have been a totally different book. Jerry Sternin is a researcher, I think, out of Connecticut. And he went to Vietnam to help alleviate childhood starvation, hunger, diarrhea. And the traditional way to do that would be to show up with a bunch of studies, a bunch of powdered milk, a bunch of money, and tell the people in the village in Vietnam exactly what to do. But what Jerry did instead is he and his partner went there and looked at the village until they found a family that was doing great, a family that wasn't malnourished, a family where the kids were doing fine. And he said to that woman, come, teach the people at the next hut. Teach the people over here. Teach the whole village. By finding a deviant who stands out by being better, not by being worse, and giving that deviant a platform, he led from the bottom up. Not a good expression, bottom up, but it's the best way I have to talk about it. That is where real leadership happens. That what's been fascinating for me with the tribe is my temptation was to do everything. And to say to do this, and to do this, and to do this, because I'm a leader, that's what I'm supposed to do. And I forced myself not to do that. And as a result, we're talking about thousands and tens of thousands of posts, and hundreds of groups. We're talking about being online at Sunday morning at 4:30, and there were 31 other people there. Right? That these folks, you, stood up and said, I want to lead this a little bit, I want to lead this a little bit, and many failures occurred. But that's okay, because no one really saw those. But when successes happened, when the positive deviants stepped up, it was easy to shine a light on them. It was easy to say, look what this person did, look what that person did. And so the tribe gets stronger. If I look online at Etsy, Etsy is giving eBay a run for its money in the handmade crafts business. What you notice is that the people who sell on Etsy do a lot of the buying on Etsy. That the providers are also the buyers. What you notice is if you go to Etsy and become a new seller, ostensibly you're competition for the old sellers. But the old sellers will rush over and tell you how to do it better. That what has been built here is a very lightweight, from a top-down point of view, tribe. Or this is the Longaberger Basket Company. This is actually their headquarters. It looks like a basket. And the people who collect Longaberger baskets are also the people who sell Longaberger baskets, and they're obsessed with it just as much as the Etsy people are obsessed with what they're selling. What it comes down to is what Kevin Kelly talked about. This might be the whole world, but all you need is 1,000 true fans. All you need are 1,000 people who will cross the street for you, who will show up, not sure why, who will pre-order that item without actually understanding all its implications, because they're insiders. They're the ones you've persuaded. So if you're an author and you can't get 100 people to love your book enough to tell their friends, then you shouldn't publish your book. It doesn't matter how many blurbs you get. It doesn't matter how much bookstore display you get. If you can't get 100 people, you lose. That's a really hard thing for a lot of marketers to get through their head. So I'm going to let you think about that for a second. So I want to give you a couple examples of what's worked and what hasn't, and the thinking behind it, because I hope you'll see the variety that's here. This is one of my favorite examples to talk about. And now that my wife doesn't work at Audible/Amazon anymore, I'm allowed to talk about it. This is a Kindle, and it could have been an unbelievable home run. And maybe one day Jeff will make it that. But right now, it's just an ebook reader. It's an ebook reader that I have to use by myself. And that the only way it sells is when someone likes it enough that they tell two or three of their good friends, you should get one too. And generally, we're finding that women are the ones who are doing that, and most of the people who use a Kindle are women. But wait a minute. They had such an opportunity to lead and connect a tribe. Book readers are only 5% of the population. We're desperately looking for other book readers all the time. So why isn't it that I can get one of these for everyone in my book group, and as I'm reading, I can see what they're saying on each page about what I just read? Why can't I make it so that as a business person, when I look at business books to buy on the Kindle, I can't sort them by percentages of book read before the person stopped reading it? Right? Why can't the whole thing turn into a communications platform that happens to have books as its fuel? Because if he had done that, if they had launched the Kindle that way, it would have become the essential element for all the people in the tribe. Because you needed to know what the other people were thinking. You desperately want to be connected. If there's only 400 people who read an obscure Ukrainian novel, don't you want to know who the other 400 people are, at least what they think of what you just read? You're dying to know who read that book that you just read, so that you can share it. You can't right now. Not with this, and not with a paper book. Part of the reason this is hard is because being a leader means doing something worth being criticized for. And your whole life, you've been told not to do that. First grade, second grade, fourth grade, eighth grade, 12th grade, don't wear that costume for Halloween. People might think you're a dork. Then we go to work, and there's the manual, and there's the supervisor, and there's the bus. Don't do that, you might get in trouble. You go to set up at the Consumer Electronics Show. Don't plug that in, the electrician has to do it for you. Over and over and over again, we're told, don't do something that might get you put in the corner. But that's all leaders do, all day long. And we say, well, I'll do that when I'm the boss. I don't have enough leverage to do that right now. It's not my job. Well, I want to talk to you about a guy named Tom Barnett. If you think you work for a bureaucracy, let's talk about Tom Barnett. Tom worked for the Pentagon, one of the biggest bureaucracies in the history of mankind. He was at the lowest possible level, associate professor at the War College, hundreds of miles from Washington, D.C. He made a PowerPoint about the future of the Pentagon. He showed five people at the War College. They were so excited about what they saw, they made him show it to 10 people, and then 50 people, and he worked his way through, and then he started traveling to Washington, and the last stop, he showed the PowerPoint to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. How did he do that? He did it by saying something no one wanted to hear, they said, until he did it. And then when he did it, they realized it's exactly what they needed to hear, and they needed other people to hear it too. So by doing that very first little step, possibly offending five people, he created a movement within the Pentagon that got him all the way to the top. A key part of thinking here is you don't need everyone. You just need some people, a few people. That's a really hard thing to think about. Let me give you a couple examples from the music industry. Okay, Harry Chapin, I was a big fan of his. He was famous. Why? Was it because he went from coffee house to coffee house to coffee house until 200 million people had heard him? No. He was famous because one disc jockey loved his work, even wrote a song about the disc jockey. And by playing that music until it got through to people, it spread to other radio stations. And 100 disc jockeys or 1,000 disc jockeys made all the difference in him having impact. Very top-down approach. Harry Chapin had a daughter, Jen. Jen is building a tribe. One person at a time. She knows she can't go to DJs, but even if she could, that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to touch people, connect with them, connect them to each other, and lead them somewhere. And as a special treat, Jen and her husband Stefan are here, and I think they'd like to sing for me.
storm, the streets look dead, it starts to rain. It begins to rain.
Steps involved, or do you think it's pretty straightforward? What's fascinating, other than the sheer talent and insight of the two of them and the work, is that it makes sense. That it makes so much more sense to know that people can just Google Jen Chapin, and then they'll figure it out, and then they'll join, and then they'll connect, and then they'll follow, and then it'll grow, and then it'll grow if you earn it. Than it does to hope that some guy in a suit and a limo will introduce you to some other guy and pay him to play you on the radio, and maybe, just maybe, you'll get played on the radio again, and maybe you'll show up in a record store, oh, I forgot they're out of business. No, it doesn't work anymore. That what Jimmy Buffett does for a living is what the Grateful Dead used to do for a living. Jimmy Buffett doesn't try to have top 40 songs anymore. Jimmy Buffett understands that the parrot heads want to go to a party, and they want to meet other parrot heads, and that's what he does for a living. He connects them. He leads them. Kristen Hirsch has been making music for 20 years, even though she looks like she's about 15. What Kristen did is she built a blog, and she writes provocative stuff, and she sings provocative songs, and she has a following. One day she said, wouldn't it be neat if I offered my tribe a chance to buy a CD for $50? But for $50, I will re-record each song on the CD, so it's one and only one. And you get to pick which any 8 or 10 of the 2,000 songs that she's recorded. So she puts it on her blog. 20 minutes later, at 50 bucks a piece, she sold 100. Now she says, wait a minute, that's a lot of songs to sing over and over and over. So she made a little bit of an error. But the important thing is that she doesn't care about everyone. She doesn't have to care about everyone, that the world is now lined up to make it so that we can succeed by working with the passionate, as opposed to constantly provoking the board and the people who don't want to hear from us. So let me share three different elements of tribes and what kind of people join. The first one is fascinating. This is a woman named Delmar, and she just died. She was the first woman to be married in San Francisco to another woman after the law passed. And she was 92 when she died. When Adele was 21, she read a book that had the word lesbian in it. And she said, until that day, she didn't realize she wasn't the only one in the world. And that once she found out that she could join a tribe that she was already in, she was there. And her life was changed. Compare that to Fast Company. Those of us who read Fast Company in the old days, we knew there were other people just like us. We were sure of it. We just didn't know where to find them. We didn't know where the meetings were held, right? We didn't know what we were supposed to wear or say to tell everybody else that we were one of them. And then when Ramon's T-shirts comes along or Fast Company comes along and is able to give people who already know they're in a way to announce they're in this, they thrive. The third thing is the hardest one, which is to create a tribe where there was not one before. The people at this political rally for president, they wouldn't have been sitting next to each other at any other meeting, at any other rally, at any other event. That's hard to do. When Nike launched their sneakers and the whole idea of being an athlete for fun, there weren't legions of marathon runners. There weren't people who woke up in the morning and said, boy, I'm a marathon runner. I wonder where the other ones were. They invented the tribe of doing it, and as a result, have a very powerful position. The Beatles did not invent teenagers, right? They merely led them. Hugo Chavez did not invent the disaffected lower class of Venezuela. He merely chose to lead them. Bob Marley did not invent Rastafarians. He just showed up to lead them when they needed someone to lead them. So one way of thinking about this, as we talked about, is you can say, everybody's welcome, come on in. But the other way that's fascinating is say, no one's welcome, you must apply. And they both work, which is why there isn't one set of tactics that works for everyone. I was talking to someone on the phone the other day. There's a restaurant downtown run by Graydon Carter, who's a fancy magazine editor in New York. As far as they know, they have an unlisted phone number. They're not officially open yet. It's been over a year that they've been testing the place out. And every single night, it's totally full. And there's a line to get in. And if you show up and he doesn't know you or know who sent you, you can't get in. Sorry, we're full. And yet, his restaurant's doing great. And will continue to do great while other restaurants are begging for people to show up. The Statue of Liberty is not a symbol of control. She doesn't get to tell people what to do. Statue of Liberty doesn't say, you get to do this, you get to do that. Statue of Liberty is a symbol for a tribe. It doesn't matter that it's made out of copper. What matters is that it stands for something and connects people. What never connects people is being average. What never connects people is being in the middle, being safe. This bell curve, if I had to pay a dollar every time I use it, I'd be in big trouble. The bell curve says, wait, Walmart, Kmart, let's go to the middle. That's where the masses are. The masses don't join tribes when they get started. They join tribes right at the end. That the only chance you've got is to be over here or over here. In your organization, if there's 100 people or 1,000 people, and you're in the middle following every rule, you're not going to attract a tribe of people to follow you. You may work your way up to you, you can order them to follow you, but that's not nearly as satisfying or as powerful. Which leads to the most important part, and I've been warming you up for an hour so I can get to the part that's really important to you, which is heretics. So Martin Luther, one of the most famous heretics, said, everyone should have a Bible. He said, the churches should belong to the people, they should be built that way. And as a result, he was excommunicated, and he got into huge trouble. He also started a massive branch of a religion. It's not possible to be a heretic and a sheepwalker at the same time. Sheepwalkers are like sheep and sleepwalking put together. They're following the instructions. They're doing what they're told. They follow, maybe, but they certainly don't leave. This is what a heretic looks like. And we still don't know his name. But what we know is that his ability to stand up for what he thought was right galvanized millions and millions of people. And sometimes it does work. Sometimes it does work. This is my friend Robin Waters. Robin worked at Target before it was called that, when it was Target. And Target was Kmart, but dustier. But it wasn't doing great. And she came up with the concept, working with a team, of let's get Michael Graves to make a teapot. Let's figure out how to bring in high design at low prices. The CEO didn't come up with that. She did. And she was almost as low as you could go without being a cash register clerk. But she built a tribe, and she worked it through the organization until it became the organization. Jim Morrison got arrested. He got booed off stage. He wasn't immediately a hero. Now people visit his grave because he stood out and stood for something. So this part is tricky nomenclature, so I put some words in these slides. There's a difference between faith and religion. Faith is human nature. Faith is believing in the future, believing in connection, believing in things can get better. Faith is what gets everyone moving. Religion are rules that get invented to support faith. And I mean with a small f and a small r. You can have faith in the pleasure of ice cream. That's fine with me. Religion are the rules created by human beings to enforce the status quo, to enforce the power structure. And what heretics do is they have so much faith, they have no choice but to challenge the religion. The religion of what it means to work at McDonald's. The Big Mac was invented by a franchisee outside of Pittsburgh. Someone who was so passionate about what he did all day and his franchise and the future of fast food that he broke every rule in McDonald's religious handbook to make the Big Mac. He was a heretic too. And what's so hard is that lots and lots of people have faith, but then plopped on top of that are all these various religions, these rules, these structures. Why were they built? They were built to let someone who probably isn't in the room with you control the situation. And the challenge that organizations have is that when your dogma steps on my karma, we don't get anywhere. And that organizations that want to grow have to figure out where the line is. Where are the things that are about what we believe and how we treat customers? What we believe in the side effects of organization creates? What we believe in the purpose of our products? Versus the rules that we invented to amplify that. This is not about control. If you try to control the system, you will not find a tribe show up. That McDonald's, as I said, is controlling it. This young person probably has a lot of faith. But because they're Amish, there's also a lot of religion and rules that get in the way of that. And the same thing is true at the disco. The way you dress, what time you show up, who you talk to, how you dance. There's religion. There's rules that get in the way. So let me go back to the record business and pick on it a little bit because I think it makes it distinct. A revolution hit the record business. The revolution was that black vinyl thing that degraded over time, couldn't be copied, was a souvenir, nice big picture, worth paying for. That was the engine that built the music industry. But the faith that built the music industry was people love music. Great musicians will keep coming. With help, great musicians can get even better. Music likes to spread, and when it spreads, that's a good thing. All of a sudden, the world goes digital, and the music industry doesn't go, great, new opportunities to pursue our faith. The music industry says, who can we sue? Because they're breaking our religion. And as a result, they completely annihilated themselves. Not music, but the music industry, the people who wear the suits. Blew it. Billions of dollars down the drain, the biggest opportunity in their career lost. The internet is radio cubed. Could have been a bonanza if they had stuck to what they believed in as opposed to trying to stick to rules that weren't working anymore. The Joan of Arc taught people that if you stand up, you can make things actually better. Most people work in a balloon factory. Now, the thing about balloon factories is they're quiet, and they're safe, and they're comfortable. There isn't really a busy season for balloons because it's for birthdays year-round. And they like it. And every once in a while, a unicorn shows up. Unicorns are not particularly popular in balloon factories. And so standing up in front of you, begging you to become the unicorn in whatever factory you work in, is very frightening. That's why my book isn't called The Unicorn in the Balloon Factory, because Lisa made me change it. But how you talk to people about where you're going matters. If I had stood up and called the book Unicorn in the Balloon Factory, a whole bunch of people would say, I can't go there. That's too scary. But if, on the other hand, you build a tribe of people, a tiny tribe of people in your organization, who believe in the faith of where you're going, then over time, all of them are going to become unicorns. All of them are going to want to see the rules go away. That we know there are lots of rules. Some of the rules have good reason. Right? I don't know if you can read that. It says, warning, electric fence. And the little girl grabbed me in the car and died. But most of the rules are a little outdated. And then what we're going to have to do if we want to lead is understand that the rules aren't the point. The faith is the point. And that the people who get in trouble in organizations are the ones who break the rules for the wrong reason. But an organization is when you break the rules for the right reason, to serve a customer, to accomplish the organization's mission, to grow in the right way. Nothing bad ever happens. The rules are there for the other people. So one of the ways we approach this is by getting rid of little no's. Little no's don't help us. What we're seeking is the big yes. Not go to your boss and say, I went to see Seth and I got this great idea, can I do it? Because if you say that to her, of course she'll say no. You know why? Because if it fails, you blame her. And if it succeeds, you'll take all the credit. Why on earth would she say yes to that? What you do is you find the moment when you have the following, when you've built the proof, when the thing is moving. That's when you're going to get a big yes. Red Maxwell, a dear friend of mine, has a daughter, Cassie, who has juvenile diabetes. Red is impatient. Red is not willing to wait for a bureaucracy to figure out how to get its act together to help Cassie get better. So Red's a heretic. Red is trying in every direction he can, with as much energy as he can, to build a tribe of people who are actually changing things. Jackson Pollock got thrown out of at least one art class, I can guarantee you, because this does not look like a final exam for 1941. But the fact is, by reinventing art, he showed a whole bunch of other people how to think about what they do. A guy named Rob Bell wrote a controversial book that evangelical Christians are spending time reading that talks about this exact point, which is that it's possible to lead without doing it the way everyone else does it. A dear friend of mine, Megan McDonald, who's here today, is a coach. She teaches people how to do something really scary, and in my estimation, sort of dumb, which is climb rocks and maybe fall. But most of the time, not fall. And the way she coaches is not by acting like Vince Lombardi, not by saying, everyone go do this, everyone go do this, yelling, humiliating the way we've seen so many sports coaches do it. What she does is she assembles groups of people and she talks to them in a whisper sometimes. And then she leads them to where they need to go and walks away. And the group leads itself from that point. They coach each other. 12-year-olds helping 14-year-olds figure out their way through a rock problem. That what we see is that being a community organizer, organizing people to make a difference, is the way you make change happen. That what we see is that it's not about top-down yelling. It's about making the choice to lead. And where we're coming full circle here is that the definition of marketing, if I'm right, is now no longer clever copywriting or interesting media buying or even how do I cut 5 cents out of the cost of that product. That the future of marketing is deciding to be a leader. So, 7 elements. That I think leaders have when they're working with a tribe. First, they challenge people. They push people outside their comfort zone because you don't need to join a tribe to be safe. Second, they create a culture for the tribe. All tribes have some level of culture. If the leader works hard to create that culture, that tone, then it's more likely to catch on. They have curiosity. They don't say, this isn't in my religion, therefore I cannot consider it, examine it, or decide if it's true or not. They are curious about what's happening in the outside world. They look at it on its own merits. Then they decide if it's something they want to embrace, if it's something they want to follow. They have charisma, but here's the cool thing. Charisma does not make you a leader. Being a leader gives you charisma. I don't care if you were born shy or with a stutter or fear standing up in front of people. There are plenty of leaders who were. That it doesn't matter if you're eloquent. It matters if you choose to do this, and by doing it, you become charismatic because leaders communicate to the people in their tribe. They do it often, they do it well, and then they connect the people in their tribe to each other. And lastly, they commit. They commit to the movement. The movement can tell when you haven't made that commitment. So these are my business cards. Maybe your picture is here. And I think at least one of you, I recognize them. There you are. You're a nice person. Thank you for coming. So, on the back of my business cards, which I got from Woo.com, great name, is pictures of my readers. Because it's a reminder to me that my job is not to find more readers. I have enough readers. My job is to write things that my readers want to read. To to write things that will enable them to go find someone, because they need more people to get it. That's why they became my readers in the first place. So what do tribe members want? They want to connect with each other. They want meaning. No one has enough meaning in their life. Everyone's looking for more. They want to make a difference. We want to do something beyond ourselves. We want to be noticed. We want to be singled out. We want not just the leader, but the other members of the tribe to see us. We want to matter. And I guess if I was going to sum them all up in the last one, the most important one is this. Most people want to be missed. If you don't show up, is someone going to miss you? Or are you just another 50 cents in the till? Are you just another person sitting in a seat? That this idea of being missed informs so many of the tribes in our community. Tribes make you smarter. They make you smarter because you're not just yelling into the ether and seeing what happens. They make you smarter because you say something to the tribe and the tribe talks back to you. And the tribe talks to each other. So, quick Starbucks case study. Starbucks blew it. They lucked into a tribe. It turns out that coffee and certain architecture and certain locations magically attracted a group of people, some road warriors, some yuppies, some self-employed, some people who are hipsters, whatever, who all liked each other. And it was our club. And I could go to Baltimore and walk into Starbucks and I would feel right at home. And the coffee was the secret handshake. It cost $4. That was the admission fee. We wasn't there for the coffee. We were there to be part of the tribe, to connect. Now, if they had sat down 5 years ago and said, how do we do more for this tribe? How do we empower this tribe? How do we connect this tribe? How do we do things for this tribe so they're more likely to use us as the place they go, as the connector? They would be a little smaller today and a lot more successful. But instead, Starbucks said, how can we sell coffee to people who go to Dunkin' Donuts? What a mistake. Because that's the old way. That's about how do we get another $3 from another stranger, not how do we connect people. There are a lot of tools in the toolbox here. I haven't talked about any of them. The Facebooks and the MySpace and the LinkedIn, you know, all the technology tools. I haven't talked about the tools in the real world. I haven't talked about using Meetup to find out, because it doesn't matter. It just matters that you pick tools that work for you and use them to the fullest extent possible by going to the extreme. Now, my job isn't to tell you what to do. It's to inspire you to inspire other people. That what makes me so excited about talking about this book and working on the book is that this is what all of us need. That we don't need another widget. We don't need another thing. We need a connection. Down the street, if you're from out of town, F.A.O. Schwartz, is the Little Mismatch collection. Now, when I first started talking about Little Mismatch, they were doing $1 million a year in revenue. This year, they'll do $40 million, and it's been 5 years. Little Mismatch is growing by leaps and bounds. Why? Because it's the uniform for the tribe. Kids don't need socks and dolls. What they need, if you're a 12-year-old fashion-forward girl, is the ability to go to your friends during recess and say, want to see my socks? Right? Want to see my socks? I can even do this. Want to see my socks is the uniform of the tribe. And as long as Little Mismatch understands that that's what they do for a living, they're going to do great. It's about this. If I had a button, it would say this. Am I doing it for my tribe or to my tribe? Four versus two. Because marketers do things to people all the time, especially the spammers who call you home during dinner. They're doing something to you. And they think they deserve it. They're entitled. Well, you're not on the do not call list, but it's wrong. But they do it to us because that's the way it's always been done, because that's their job. And what leaders do, what people with tribes do, they do it for us. So the last story, I think, that I'm going to tell you is about another hero of mine, a guy named Nathan Winograd. Nathan Winograd went to work for the SPCA of San Francisco, number two guy there. His boss looked at the statistics and realized that 4 million dogs and cats were murdered, not put to sleep, but actually murdered every year by humane shelters around this country. The humane shelters were started originally in New York to get stray dogs and cats off the street, not to let families have adoptions around Easter, but no, to get them off the street, whatever happened to them, the city would pay you money. And Nathan and his boss looked at this and said, this cannot stand. We're taking within 24 hours of taking them off the street, we're just killing all these animals. They committed, there's that word, to make San Francisco a no-kill shelter. And the insider community freaked out. That's completely unacceptable. When they went to the San Francisco board to get a law passed that would permit them to do this, members from humane societies across the country flew to San Francisco to testify against them. How dare you? It can't be done. It's the wrong thing to do. But they persisted. And Nathan reached out, not to the insiders, but to the outside community, raised more money than had ever been raised by any humane shelter. And got San Francisco to be a 95% no-kill city. Only dogs and cats killed in San Francisco were aggressive or rabid or sick. And I was like, well, yeah, that's San Francisco. So he left there and went to Tompkins County, New York, which is a rural community near Utica. Poor, not yuppie, no budget, running a tiny animal shelter. He took it from 100% to 5%. Once again, using nothing but community volunteers and community money, led a tribe, changed it. Then he went to North Carolina, did it again. Then he went to Reno, and he did it again. City after city after city. One guy, no money, no authority, no budget, changing the lives of millions of animals. But more important, I think, changing the lives of tens of thousands of volunteers who found a sense of meaning, who found something to commit to, who found a way to connect. So the question I ask you is, where's yours? That it turns out, unfortunately, this is not an opportunity. Now that you know about it, it's an obligation. Then what you have to do, if you want this world to be better, if you want your life to be better, is you have to do this. The only reason you won't is because you don't want to, not because you can't. And I'm betting, with all the hoops you had to go through to get here, with all your enthusiasm, with all your smarts, that it's you, the people in this room, who can be that. Thank you for your attention.
Been listening to Marketing Over Coffee. You can hear Mr. Penn daily at the Financial Aid Podcast and read more at ChristopherSPenn.com. Mr. Wall blogs daily at RoninMarketeer.com and podcasts The M Show every Monday.
The Marketing Over Coffee theme song is called Mellow G by Funkmasters, and you can find it at the Podsafe Music Network at PodsafeMusicNetwork.com or follow the link in our show notes.